This past week was spring break for many of us, a time when I was younger, when I was growing up, that my family sometimes would go skiing in Colorado. And on one of these trips, one afternoon, high up on the mountain, my brother David and I, intermediate skiers at best, took a wrong turn. And we found ourselves on a peak with only three ways down. They were all fearfully named Black Diamond Expert runs. And our choices were a run to the left called Doom and Gloom. Then there was one on the right called Test Pilot. And finally in the middle, there was Mine Shaft. Well, after considerable anxious deliberation, we decided on Mine Shaft. Though true to its name, it was forbidding. It pitched almost straight down, it seemed like, just like the other two, way out of our league. And David, my brave brother, started down first, taking it slow, weaving left and right. I stood above, watching his line, seeing which way he went. Then I took a deep breath and started down myself. And to my surprise, rather than fear, what I began to feel was that exhilaration of a Colorado high adventure, the thrill of speed, that sense of really being alive, that incredible, I'm right at the edge but still in control kind of feeling. I mean, this was fun. This was great. I recall thinking, this is utterly amazing. Well, that's when the moguls appeared. The first one slammed my knee into my jaw, chipping a tooth and cutting my tongue. The second mogul detached both of my skis from my feet. And the third mogul, well, there was no third mogul for me. I landed hard in the snow, disoriented, my mouth bleeding, my skis now 30 or 40 feet uphill from me. My brother, concentrating on his own dire circumstance, didn't see me or couldn't stop and continued on down the mountain. But I was able to get up after a minute and retrieve my skis, and eventually I got down the hill where my brother asked me what had happened. And of course, he couldn't understand me because my tongue was mangled. But it was really as simple as this. I should never have been up there in the first place. I was on a trail, I was on a path on which I really didn't belong. Well, over the last month, as we've journeyed into Lent with this sermon series on the book of Revelation, we've called the Seven Lampstands, we've been exploring the vision which the Apostle John had and then conveyed to seven churches in Asia Minor, churches in which in the text are each represented by the image of a lampstand. And what we've been trying to do with this is quite unlike what many do with the book of Revelation. That is, we're not trying to figure out how or when the world might end. We're not trying to figure out who will get raptured into heaven in the future. No, instead, what we're doing is letting each of these lampstands, if you will, cast a light onto our lives so we can figure out how to live better right now. And you heard Sharna read our text a moment ago, referencing a congregation in a place called Thyatira, who, while they're commended for doing a lot right, loving, serving, persevering through suffering, are also committing a sin in the first century that sounds impressively like one we commit in the 21st. We get on the wrong path, we get on the wrong trail, and we worship the wrong thing. Now, if you're like me, your understanding of the sin of idolatry was perhaps overly informed by the movie The Ten Commandments. You'll remember it. After seeing it, I thought the only way one could break the second commandment, thou shalt not serve nor bow down to any other gods, was how they did it in the movie. When Charlton Heston, at his Charlton Hestonish, playing Moses came down from Mount Sinai to find a cast of thousands not only dancing provocatively around a golden calf, but going so far as to blatantly bow down before it. And while in that moment, as a kid, I firmly resolved that if I ever crossed paths with the golden calf, I would never bow down before it. It's also accurate to say that at that point, I just checked this commandment off my list and didn't worry much about it anymore. When the truth is that not only is this the commandment probably that we break more than any other commandment, that this is exactly what was going on in Thyatira. They've gotten on the wrong path, they've gotten on the wrong trail, and they're bowing down to the wrong thing. The text tells us the church is tolerating a false prophet called Jezebel, which although it could be someone real of that name in their midst, it's much more likely that it's a scriptural reference to a woman named Jezebel in the Old Testament. Jezebel, we're told in the book of Kings, married Israel's sovereign, a man named Ahab, and promptly began to lure not only him, but the whole nation down a perilous path and away from God. Now, Thyatira, in the first century, was apparently a big trading center, a big commercial, bustling commercial hub, where there were a number of what we today might think of as trade associations. That is to say, there each vocation, each craft, the bronze workers, the garment makers, the tanners, the potters, the bakers, they each had their own trade guild. And each guild would hold their own ceremonies celebrating their industry and its work. And at these ceremonies, they each asked their patron pagan god to bless their work for protection and for prosperity for their trades. And sometimes, like a wild office party of sorts, these celebrations then degenerated into even more licentious conduct. And that's probably where this Jezebel reference comes from. But what this letter is saying to those in this church, in this city, was while as believers you may see all this as just something you've got to be a part of in furtherance of your day-to-day business interests, it's idolatry all the same. And you heard the tone of judgment over that in the text, which all begs the question for us here 2,000 years later. Do we do that too? Is there anything we're doing today, while it may not seem like bowing down before a golden calf, while it may not seem like bowing down before a Jezebel, is actually idolatry all the same? That's our question for today. David Foster Wallace was a brilliant writer, a deep thinker, and a kind person. He struggled with depression and addiction and tragically took his own life at age 46. But through all his tribulations, he came to know a great deal about how human beings get drawn down dark and difficult paths. And one of the most profound things he ever wrote or ever said was this: there's no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships, he said, whether you're religious or not. It's how we're wired as human beings. And the only choice we get, the only choice we have, is what we worship. My friend Louis Giglio puts a finer point on it in his book, The Air That We Breathe, in which he wrote, "Worship is about value. It's saying this person, this thing, this experience, this whatever it is what matters most to me. It's a thing I've chosen to put first in my life. Simply put, whatever's worth most to us is what influences and dominates our thoughts. It's what dictates our calendars. It's what determines our actions." Even more pointedly, Louis put it like this: if you follow the trail of your time, of your affections, of your energy, of your emotion, of your money at the end of the trail, you'll find an altar. And on that altar, there's a throne. And whatever or whomever is on that throne is what you worship. It's your object of worship. And though we don't walk around saying, I worship my phone, we don't walk around saying, I worship my work, I worship this pleasure or this person or this thing, the trail never lies. That is to say, though some of the things we do every day may not seem like bowing down before a golden calf or before a graven image, can be idolatry all the same. Now, don't raise your hand. I'm not a raising your hand kind of guy here. But in your mind, how many of these boxes do you check? Do you follow politics at the national level more than is healthy? So much so, in fact, that you love one side, you've developed this smoldering or even burning contempt for the other. Does a particular cable TV host get under your skin? Does a particular politician emotionally really set you off? Are you that invested? Is politics or political news your idol? Or do you get caught up too much in sports? Is that where your emotional energy goes? Or to your kids' activities and schedules? Do you go overboard with video games? Is that where your time disappears to? Do you have a social media addiction? Are you obsessed with curating a certain picture of yourself, a version that others will admire? Are you in debt because you buy stuff that you don't really need? Are you chasing honor, prestige, or popularity, or superiority over others a good deal more than you'd like to admit? Is that what drives you? Are you on your phone too much? Is that your idol? Are you so driven to succeed at work or at school that you have no energy for your loved ones when you get home at the end of the day? Or maybe it's something else. But we need to ask, each one of us, how are we spending our time? Who and what is getting the best of us? Where are our highest energies going? To what or to whom is our money going? Where do our deepest loyalties reside? Because if the trail never lies, we might need a serious course correction in our lives. Second question for today. If we, like the church in Thyatira, are guilty of idolatry, and I'm afraid I checked off a number of boxes there myself. If we are, whatever it might be, guilty of worshiping something other than God, then how might we turn this thing around? Well, our text in Revelation 2 provides three encouraging phrases in verses 25 and 26 that if we absorb, that if we internalize, that if we put into our lives, they ought to help us stay on the right trail, on the right path. And here they are. This is from the Message translation. First, hold on to the truth that you have, we're told. Second, we're told there's a reward, a victory that will come to those who, quote, keep at it. And finally, the third encouragement is this: refuse to give up. Hold on to the truth, keep at it, and refuse to give up. First things first. Let's look at what it might mean to hold on to the truth. Well, if we're to hold on to the truth, the first thing we will have to ask is, what is the truth? What is truth? Well, as we get closer to Holy Week now, you'll recall that this is the exact question that Pontius Pilate asked to Jesus after Jesus had been arrested. But what's strange about it is that Jesus doesn't answer the question. Instead, with blinding speed, Barabbas is freed, Jesus is scourged, there's a crown of thorns, and Jesus is soon nailed to the cross. Which makes one think, why would God's word pose, then leave the ultimate question of all of human history, what is truth, unanswered? Well, the easy answer is God didn't leave it unanswered. For though Christ made no audible response to Pilate's question, he answered over the next several hours with his actions. He answered with his life. The question, what is truth, it's answered for us on the cross. What is truth? For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him shall not perish, but have everlasting life. What is truth? Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. What is truth? It is accomplished. It is finished. What is truth? The truth is, God loves us. And it's this that we're told to hold on to here, to hold fast to this. God is love. Hold on to the truth. Second encouragement is keep at it. I love that. Keep at it. Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel survived the Holocaust and became a professor and a writer when he came to America. He was the rarest of human beings, a true holy man. And just a few weeks before he died in 1973, Heschel was interviewed and asked if he had any advice for the next generation. And he told the reporter this. Let them remember, he said, that there is meaning beyond absurdity. Let them be sure that every little deed counts, that every word has power, and that we must do our share to redeem the world in spite of all of its frustrations and all of its disappointments. What he was saying was that the world is not all random. The world is not all chaos. It is not all meaningless. It's not absurd. It's ordered, even when it doesn't seem like it. It's ordered and can be reordered by God's love poured out to the world through us. So keep at it. Through your disappointments and through your frustrations, keep at it. Through all your own mistakes and your own missteps and your detours off the trail, keep at it. Get back on the path. Keep doing those things that the church in Thyatira was committed for doing at the beginning of this passage. Keep living out your faith in love. Keep serving. Keep persevering through difficulty and suffering. Keep at it. Keep at it. The third and final encouragement instructs us to refuse to give up. When you find that right line, that right trail, stay on it. For it's this one, the passage says and tells us, who receives the victory. Franz Klammer is generally considered the greatest downhill skier of all time, and his victory, his gold medal in the 1976 Winter Olympics in Austria, is said not only to have been the greatest downhill run of all time, but the popularity of snow skiing soared after ABC's broadcast of the race during its coverage of the Winter Olympics that year. Some of you may even remember Frank Gifford and Bob Beatty's iconic call of the race. Bernhard Russi of Switzerland had slalomed down the mountain with precision and speed at what seemed to be an unbeatable time. And Klammer, when it came his turn, he was in 15th place, but he charged from the gate at the top of the mountain. He almost crashed near the top two or three times. Beatty was yelling into Gifford's ear, "Klammer is all over the mountain." And Klammer was behind Russi's time at the first intermediate split, a third of the way down the mountain. He was behind at the second intermediate split, two-thirds of the way through the race. But then on the final pitch of the course, Klammer somehow found a line that no other skier had skied. Rusi himself, in a later interview with his second place silver medal around his neck, said, "No one had thought that the line Clomer took on that last pitch was even possible. Yet Franz not only found it, he skied it. And that's how he won. That's how he gained the victory." To gain the victory that God puts on offer to us requires that we find and take a different path, a different trail, a different line than the rest of the world, not bowing down before any of the counterfeit gods that life offers us, but instead to hold on to the truth, to keep at it, and to refuse to give up.